You're listening to the best of Drew and Mike. We're off for a few days. The Drew and Mike store is open. And Luke Nowacki is not so wacky when it comes to planning your financial future. He'll do a great job for you. Whether you've got a 401k and you want to check your investments and see if you're still earning good money on them, or they just don't fit your current lifestyle, or perhaps you just haven't planned at all. Maybe you need to plan your financial future or your child's education. So many people, kids get up 4, 6, 8, 10, no plan whatsoever. Please let Luke help you make a plan. Call Luke Nowacki's team at 248-663-4748. Security Investment Advisory Services offered through Royal Alliance Associates Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Royal Alliance Associates Incorporated is separately owned. Other entities and or marketing names, products, or services referenced here are independent of Royal Alliance Associates. Luke Nowacki, 248-663-4748. There's all kinds of stuff going on, and we were just talking about the Rolling Stone documentaries, which have been airing on HBO.
Yep, two parts, 4 hours total. I really like that documentary. I like the way they did the narration with Jeff Daniels. Everything Daniels narrated was an article from the magazine.
I screwed up and watched part two first.
I don't know if it
matters.
It's
funny because the way it ended, I know, it doesn't really matter. I think I probably know part one pretty well.
Well, I don't know.
I mean,
you probably do.
I don't think I know Rolling Stone inside out that well. I mean, I what they're talking about all feels very familiar. I'm interested to hear their view of what happened, and I have to tell you that part two, you know, it's strange that I would find so much interest in it, but I was kind of like you. I thought the Bill Clinton part and the Jimmy Swaggart part were two of the best, most interesting things about it. Although I love seeing the Clash live.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, it goes chronologically through the magazine. So a lot of it in the beginning is music. The first big non-music thing they did was they did the Plastercaster.
Yeah, Cynthia Plastercaster.
But there's a lot of Hunter S. Thompson, who I just love and adore.
He's cool as hell.
Fear and Loathing on the campaign, the 72 campaign. Then they had a thing about Patty Hearst.
Patty Hearst thing was big for Rolling Stone. They covered that in a way that most people, you know, that was just a news story, sort of a daily news story. I remember that story really well because I thought it was, even though I was really young, it was such a crazy story. It was fascinating, like this young girl who's not super hot, but she was kind of cute. She was living with this guy, Stephen Weed. She gets kidnapped by the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army, and next thing you know, she's pictured holding a machine gun at a bank robbery. She's completely brought into this cult, I guess, or Stockholm Syndrome took place, whatever. Shut up, Layla! Ugh. And when they release her, or however that went down, I have trouble remembering exactly how she got out, but she got out. She was charged with the crimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why are the lights going out?
Joey went upstairs to get Layla, take care of Layla. Oh, okay. And that light bulb in the stairwell has been out for months.
Oh, well. So she's charged, and she actually served time. It's like, wait a second. She was kidnapped, and she got sucked in, but it wasn't because she was planning to be part of any bank route. I just thought that was weird. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, she falls in love with the guard at the prison and marries him, which was doubly weird. She never went back to her boyfriend that she was living with when she was kidnapped. She declared him a pig, I think, while she was... She used to write letters.
It was really crazy, though.
It
was also, but how they got the interview with her while she was still being held by the kidnappers.
Kind of El Chapo-esque. Who's would be here?
I don't know. Joe Marasso, maybe?
I guess.
The TV cranked up there? This house is utter madness right now.
Yeah, things are a little crazy. Okay. Anyway.
I'm focused on the TV on upstairs now.
Yeah. It fell out of pause. Oh, Christ.
Oh!
Do you have it queued up to Patty Hearst?
Yeah, this is part of Patty Hearst.
Why don't you play some of that? This is pretty... I forgot all about this interview.
I just hope that you'll do what they say, Dad. Just do it quickly.
Yeah, give them money.
William Randolph Hearst.
I'm not being forced is her grandfather. To say any of this.
Her name was Tanya,
we
by the way.
You,
she
Patty.
Changed her name.
I'm sorry I'm crying, but I'm happy you're safe. And be strong.
My name's not Patty
anymore.
God
will bring you back.
I believe she's safe. I believe that they are taking good care of her.
Well, she's robbing banks.
I believe these people are sincere.
Patty feared Sin Q. He told her she'd be killed if her parents did not meet the SLA's demands, and she believed him. So Patty grew impatient as the ransom negotiations bogged down. I felt my parents were debating how much I was worth. Like they figured I was worth $2 million, but I wasn't worth $10 million. It was a horrible feeling that my parents could think of me in terms of dollars and cents. I felt sick all over. By degrees, her disillusionment with her parents turned into sympathy for the SLA. Sin Q wanted her to become a comrade in arms.
Sin Q, what a stupid
Patty
name.
Patty was urged to attend SLA's daily political study sessions.
Boring!
She was invited to listen to the SLA national anthem.
Boring!
Jazz composition of wind and string that
Sin Q had
selected.
They're not even a good kidnapping cult.
They hugged her, called her sister,
it was and ended
her loneliness.
A lot of good music out then she could
Patty's
have been listening to.
Was as much emotional as political. 7 weeks after she was kidnapped, Patty changed into Tanya, an SLA soldier.
Fake!
Isn't it cool, though, how they do the narration?
Yeah.
With, just from the
Greetings
article?
To the people. This is Tanya. On April 15th,
Fake!
My comrades and I expropriated $10,660.02
expropriated.
From the Sunset Branch of the Hibernia Bank. Casualties could have been avoided had the persons involved cooperated with the people's forces and kept out of the way until after our departure.
Yeah, that's really smart.
The story was so widely covered. It was like a circus. It was O.J. Simpson before O.J. Simpson. But the mainstream media never had her side of the story until Rolling Stone found a source, someone named Jack Scott.
Jack was a writer and he wanted to write a book about the SLA. So he came to Berkeley to talk to friends who were sympathetic to the SLA, and he didn't realize quite how sympathetic they
were.
At 2 the next afternoon, at the corner of Telegraph and Dwight Way, the door opened and Jack walked into an apartment prepared for a police invasion.
You walk into the room with your pencil in your hand.
Automatic machine guns were lined up next to the windows. Grenades were stacked in strategic corners. One gun was cradled by a short, unsmiling woman.
But you don't understand just what you will say when you get home.
She was Tanya, Patricia Campbell Hurst.
Something is happening here, but you don't know what it is.
You said you were interested in the SLA. That's why we invited you here. The most important thing at this time is to help us. Jack nodded. He had over $40,000. The fugitives were welcome to
some
of that.
Where did he
money.
Get 40 grand from, this writer?
Got me.
Money Jack had. Too many wanted posters have been circulated to risk planes or trains. They would have to split up, travel by car. Jack would have to chauffeur Patty. None of the other friends were willing to drive 3,000 miles with the most famous fugitive in the country to a wooden two-story house that stood unpretentiously by a dirt road in Pennsylvania, 3 hours west of New York City. Jack and Patty made it without mishap. The farmhouse from the outside loomed tall and weathered. Patty spent long hours on a grassy hammock.
Boring!
The Pennsylvania summer seemed to relax and rejuvenate the fugitives. They picked wild blackberries from bushes growing across
Once
the road.
Again.
Boring!
For 2 months, the SLA fugitives depended solely on the Scots.
They have TV or... I mean, she has to listen to their crap national
Both
anthem all the time?
That the fugitives should leave the farmhouse by September 1st. Their friends back in Berkeley might be willing to risk helping them. A series
it
of
sounded like they had this thought out really well what they were going to do.
Patty Hearst. The new team did not want the Newsweek cover girl to be in the car when they entered a cross-country automobile trip. If Patty were to leave the farm, it seemed Jack would have to drive the getaway car. 3 days later, they reached Las Vegas. Jack dropped Patty at a prearranged motel, hugging her hard, and said goodbye. The date was September 27, 1974.
Patty Hearst was underground for a long time, about 19 months.
During that time, David and I were rewriting the story, and we could not reveal that Jack Scott was a primary source. It's hard to describe how dangerous this was.
Oh, get over yourself. You're here.
Finally, I talked to
you. This is the cool part.
And
you
I said, it's going to blow your mind, but are you willing to print a story if you don't know where the information comes from? And he said yes. He knew we had a scoop. We all knew we had a scoop.
So we got the article all ready to go.
But then all of a sudden, Patty was found and arrested.
Fuck!
She was arrested on a Friday.
Still the interview.
And we held an impromptu press conference. So it was me in a flannel shirt, basically validating our story.
The political content of their arguments about the inequitable distribution of wealth in this country and a lot of things that a lot of us would agree with.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know why they would say that the SLA had some important issues that people agreed with. They're fucking criminals. They robbed banks. They're bad, kidnapped somebody. That story wasn't, I mean, to compare it to OJ is not really terribly unfair. It's just that the media was different then. You know, there wasn't, it didn't explode. Things just, they could only get so big. I mean, people were just as interested, but.
So I, you know.
We love you, Tanya.
This was before me, but I thought it was interesting, the tabloid journalism they got into in part two about the Pulitzer divorce and Roxanne Pulitzer, which I have a very little recollection of, that they sent Hunter S. Thompson to you know, write about, which is, he's just the best writer.
Well, that whole story, there was so much focus on her sleeping with a trumpet, which was so stupid.
Yeah. When she was sleeping with like eight other dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's weird. Watching all that coverage of the SLA story, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, really reminded me of the footage of the Zodiac killer when they were looking for him. Because it's around the same time that was going on. A little earlier, but, you know, San Francisco.
And they talk about, what's Jan Wenner's wife?
Jane.
The first wife? Jane, that's one of the reasons, one of the reasons she wanted to move to New York. The other reason is Rolling Stone was getting pretty damn big, and that was the center of publishing, but she was just kind of over San Francisco and the SLA and the Night Stalker, and there was another, another
Zodiac.
Zodiac. I thought she named another one, too. She's like, I just want to get out of here.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on there, but it was a real epicenter of rock and roll because the Grateful Dead, you had on in Haight-Ashbury, you had the Jefferson Airplane lived in a mansion together.
And it starts
Quicksilver
with
Messenger Service, and yeah, Monterey.
I couldn't help but thinking though, so they get to New York in what, 77, and that's when Son of Sam happened.
Yeah, and also the city went bankrupt and the blackout, and Rolling Stone was kind of a jinx. The Swaggart story was, you know, what people, I think, so forget is that Mickey Gilley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Jimmy Swaggart are all first cousins. Mm-hmm. And they all could play the shit out of the piano, especially Jerry Lee. I love the clips they had of Jerry Lee in here.
Yeah, I like the clips of Swaggart.
Oh, yeah, Swaggart, too.
And his preaching.
And what a creep he was. I mean, it just blows my mind that this guy... televangelism, how did that... Where's the FCC when you have creeps like this begging for money every 5 seconds on television and getting it and living like kings? Why is that okay? But somebody says, shit, and, you know, it's the end of the world, and you need 19 lawyers, and your broadcast license is in trouble. But you can have this prick asking for money every 5 minutes, the Bakers stealing money they're asking for every 5 minutes, and, hey, Jim Baker's back on TV asking for money. Did you know that?
Right now, he
is? Yeah, he is. Well, yep. Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be idiots that'll hand it over.
Yeah, but where's the FCC? Why is it okay to steal money?
Where's he asking for money now, Swagger?
Oh, I don't know if Swagger...
Or not Swagger,
I don't know
what
Swagger... Baker, he's on some obscure channel, some cable. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly. They play clips of him on Stern. I like to do my boogie boogie
every day. There was this little Assembly of God church... And there was a piano that these three kids learned how to play.
Charlie!
They had very few outlets to escape, but music was one, and religion was the other.
mad at the piano.
I know. He does quite a bit.
So Jerry Lee took the musical escape route, as did Mickey Gilley.
Louis Boogie, Louis Wayne. Now me and Mickey do a boogie every day.
Look at this dope.
Swags.
Jimmy.
Pause for a second.
But he hung on.
Because we have so many millennials and younger people listening. Jimmy Swaggart was a big televangelist who raised millions and millions of dollars through his ministry. And suddenly it was determined that, oh, he was visiting prostitutes and he was cruising for whores. And it was it all came out. In fact, Playboy did a recreation of the poses that Swaggart, like this Deborah Murphy, who is this gross?
Yeah, they showed some of that. Yep.
Yeah, I know. And so Swaggart, of course, had to go before his televangelist ministry and say, "I have sinned against you, my Lord." That was the one clip that everyone loved, with tears streaming down his face. And of course, they all forgave him and kept giving money.
You know what I noticed about that clip that I've never noticed before? And we've seen it a million times. There's one obese gentleman in the crowd bawling.
A lot of people in the crowd are bawling.
I just don't remember that guy, though, who was just tears streaming down his face.
Well, it's hard not to watch Swags.
It's so weak. I liked his other ministry that they showed, too, on here.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, the author of this article on Swaggart back, what was this, 86?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Is a guy that you've interviewed.
87, I think.
You interviewed him?
What was he? What did we interview him for?
He writes a lot of religious stuff, so he wrote Going Clear.
Oh, yeah, that's
that
right.
Director.
That's right. That's right. Volume?
You're going to get sucked in by this preaching. Make some good points. Swags!
You say Jimmy Swagger? You're preaching to hundreds of millions of people.
Swags!
Third person.
You're not supposed to be that exuberantly emotional. You have lost your dignity and your decorum. I'll admit I have.
All a lie.
But when I speak of Jesus Christ,
speaking in tongues.
That he lifted man above the shadows, broke the bonds and the chains.
I don't think so.
And the shackles. Because when he walked out of that tomb, I walked out of that tomb with him. When he walked out of that tomb, I walked out of that tomb with him.
Oh, boy.
When he walked out of that tomb, Jimmy Swagger walked out of that tomb with him.
Really?
Another third
person. No single person had ever assembled such a global television audience. And it was difficult to foretell what the consequences of such a supranational phenomenon might be. Although Swaggart's goal was to evangelize the world in the last days before Armageddon, he also had allied himself with the Christian right and was vigorously pressing its social agenda.
Homosexuality, the filth that I will touch upon in this message that beggars description. I want to make a statement. The homosexuals are not gays. They are perverts. Huh? And today there are nearly 300 publicly advertised meeting places for homosexuals called glory holes.
Well, he knows
where
a lot.
Gangs of homosexuals meet.
I didn't know what glory holes were then.
And with little or no sanitation.
No sanitation.
Practice oral, anal, and oral penal sex
anal.
With men.
Anal.
Sometimes as many as 16 in a single encounter,
writhing
like snakes on the floor, protected by the United States government and politicians.
Listen to how light the clapping is.
It was kind of funny to me.
Everybody's like, what the fuck is he talking about?
I was representing Rolling Stone, which, if anything, stands for all of those cultural issues that Swaggart opposed. People in the reporting profession thought, he never believed any of this stuff anyway. He was just in it for the money and the power.
Just
so
like
I thought
LRH.
Maybe he did believe it. Maybe he is actually living out some sort of drama. I was interested in him, but the scandal gave me the excuse to write the story.
The secret that burned inside Jimmy Swaggart was that he had been a slave of sexual perversion since the age of 10.
Yep.
He had been chosen by God to evangelize the world in the last days. And yet his own soul was losing ground in a desperate battle with Satan.
I don't know if it was Satan. It was his dick.
Mm-hmm.
His cousin Mickey Gilley would say later, Jimmy to us was like Jesus walking on the face of the earth again. But Jesus was a role Jimmy wasn't quite ready to play.
You all know the very first time I saw Jimmy Swaggart?
Uh-oh.
I was standing in the Texas Motel. I told my girlfriend, I said, look at this man. He keeps riding around in this big town car. And I looked again. I said, girl, that's Jimmy Swaggart. I got in his car and he asked me if he gave me $10, would I pull down my pants and let him play with my pussy while he jacked off?
Wow. Sounds like he fingered her.
It seemed that he was more interested in depravity than in sex, and in bringing himself low.
Debbie does Swaggart.
He might have had a mistress, he might have been able to hire a high-class call girl. After all, you know, he was getting $500,000 a day.
What?
In contributions.
People what a bush. Look at that bush. Jeez.
Gross.
He had his own zip code.
Sounds like we both got pussy problems.
In the country. And yet he would go to these depressing, squalid little motels on airline highway.
That's what got him off.
Seek out women who were advertising themselves by sitting out in a plastic chair in one of the motels.
Didn't they say
what song is this, by the way?
Swaggart's life. There was a devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other. And it was almost like he was begging to be caught.
It's I Want to Be Adored.
To my Lord and my Savior.
Fake! There's the dude. See him on the right.
Go back. I missed it.
You, my Lord.
I've never seen somebody that inconsolable. All right, he'll be on the bottom right.
To my Lord and my Savior. I have sinned against you, my Lord.
Other people are crying. He's actually bobbing up and down. He can't catch his breath.
And I would ask that your precious
Stone Roses.
Remember when she made you jizz your pants?
Every stain
in my pants.
Never to be remembered against me anymore.
On April 8th, he was officially defrocked by the Assemblies of God. He has been booted off the two major Christian television networks. Students have deserted his Bible college. IRS agents are poring over his books. Maybe there is no other man in history more humiliated than me, Swaggart has said, with his usual breathtaking perspective on his own importance.
Well, I was born an original sinner. I was born from original sin.
I like Annie Lennox's voice. Would I Lie to You? What a great song.
This whole thing, it's on HBO if anybody wants to see it. It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's quite hard to turn off. I was just getting past the plaster caster in part one, because I watched part two first.
Yeah, so you haven't seen much of the Lennon-Yoko stuff.
Not really. I mean, not that it'll be new to me. But
did you ever see, well, I was going to ask, did you ever see this video when he gets in this argument with the New York Times writer?
In the Montreal bedroom or hotel room?
Fuck, I don't know.
Is he lying in bed with
Yoko?
No.
Him and Yoko are sitting in an office, and she's kind of calling him out for being fake and phony, and, you know, what is this whole movement? And he's giving it right back to her. They're both, it's just kind of an interesting argument.
Oh, I think, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
She ends up walking out, and Yoko goes, she wouldn't even answer the last question. Fuck off, Yoko. Why are you there?
There were plenty of detractors at that time.
There were, at the end of part one, Annie Leibovitz is talking about the photo before he was murdered, and Do you know the story behind that photo? Which you probably do. Why am I even asking?
She's on top of him nude.
No. He's nude. She's clothed. The cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yoko's clothed?
Yoko is clothed. He is nude, like in a fetal position. His outside leg is on top of her. Her hair is sprawled out.
Does she look like she's nude?
No. Mm-mm. If I had a screen, I'd show you.
Wow. I don't know what picture we're talking about.
It was the one that was on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
I think the most famous picture. Yeah, that's what I thought. It was their number one photo. I thought she was nude.
No, she's not nude, but that's the story behind it.
I've seen her nude, though, because they were nude on the cover of Two Virgins, the album.
Yep, and they cover that.
Which the other Beatles weren't real happy about, because that came out while the Beatles were together.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
But
John's uncirked, by the way. Kind of hung, too. Pretty hung, actually. She had a big bush.
Yeah, well, no surprise there. But, you know, so Annie goes to their house to take a picture of him because he was going to be on the cover. And he's like, I know they just want a cover of me, but can you put Yoko in it too?
Gross.
And she obliged. And then Yoko decided she wasn't going to get nude, which, you know, everybody loved. And she took the picture and then he was murdered. There's a little bit more to the story too, but I'm trying to cue it up.
He gave some incredible interviews the days before he died. I mean, he went through every single Beatles song with Playboy magazine.
Really?
Yeah.
There's the picture of it. Those two in bed. Gross. I'm gonna skip this part. Gross. Ugh.
Did not want to take her clothes off. So, of course, when they lay down together and John was nude, curled up, you know, against her clothes, I mean, he looked much more vulnerable. Well.
That picture,
okay.
I remember peeling the Polaroid and him looking at it and saying, this is it. This is our relationship.
What, he's nude and she isn't?
Yeah.
It's a weird relationship.
She takes care of him. What a pussy.
I'm in love with you.
Unfortunately, I'm in love with you too.
But in the end, I think we'll agree.
Fortunately, we don't know. But in the end, we'll find out.
That was the last picture of him. Several hours later, John was murdered. December 8th, 1980.
John Lennon, the leader of the Beatles.
One West 72nd was the call on the police radio just before 11 p.m. Officers Jim Moran and Bill Gamble were in the third blue and white that screamed to a halt outside the Dakota apartment building. The man who had been shot couldn't wait for an ambulance.
Who gives a fuck?
They stretched him out on the back seat of their car and raced to Roosevelt Hospital at the corner of 59th Street and 9th Avenue. They lifted the bloody body onto a gurney and wheeled it into the emergency room. There was nothing the doctors could do. They pronounced John Lennon dead at 11:07 p.m. We're afraid to
be alone. Now listen to how Annie and Jan make it about them. For Yoko. Drew just rolled his eyes.
What did it say about our times? What did it say about music itself? Was all this violence?
You sound like a goddamn pussy to me. Just a boy and a little girl trying to change the whole wide world.
Solution. You know, it's just to have it so seeds of evil. Who could do such a thing? I mean, he's just a musician.
You knew him personally.
Yeah.
What was he like?
He was warm and he was very witty, very funny, and very intense.
He didn't talk to you for 10 years, I believe.
John and the Beatles are part of everybody's lives, and they die, and something in you dies, and something about all your friends dies, and something about your life is, you know, you feel gone and concerned about it. It's the gathering together of a great family.
How big is that family?
Very big.
I tell you what, bitch, come join me. We get a crack rock, get a fifth of liquor, and we can smoke all goddamn night and feel better by daybreak. But we're going to be some broke bitches.
That was quite, I mean, it was huge news.
Oh, yeah.
Huge.
And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had.
I think more people are crying at Swaggart's confession than at Lennon's death, but it's close.
That fat guy was probably bawling at Swaggart's confession because he was like, oh man, I could have been doing that with you, Swags, the whole time. That's all I needed to do.
It was like watching someone you love being hit by a car.
This is actually a really good eulogy that they wrote at the time, I thought.
A song or a moment in help that may never have affected you. But you have reasons that are fundamentally the same. And that's why it was other people's reaction to John Lennon's murder that produced in me the most overwhelming despair. Rock and roll works as common experience and private obsession. The two can't really be separated. Indeed, one fuels the other.
Who gives a fuck?
I came in and they were mocking up covers just with John. You know, I had done some close-ups of John's face and his head. And, you know, I went in to see Jan, and I said, Jan, you know, I promised John that
he's not
the
around.
Cover would be him and Yoko.
Yoko is, though.
So?
And wow. Jan backed me up.
She's got a lot of power for some reason. She'll scream at you.
You know, I said it was the last promise.
You don't know it was a last promise. What, you might have promised Yoko you love her forever.
It's a gross picture.
Wash your smelly ass and balls, you nappy motherfucker, you.
That bed, when those two are lying in it, honestly, that bed smells, right? That bed looks like it just stinks.
Yoko just bums me out.
Well, okay, but John stinks too, doesn't he? Looking at him. That guy doesn't.
No, John does not stink.
Oh, bullshit.
He doesn't stink. Why really? Do you think John stinks?
Because look at him, man. He doesn't look very clean. He doesn't look very, like, you know, he's been in that bed all weekend.
It wasn't the bed in.
Well, that other bed, though, when that butler came in and gave him coffee.
Okay, I don't know. Maybe he stunk.
Why do you care?
I don't care. I really don't. I just don't think he stunk.
Brandon, will you break that tie?
Yeah, it stinks. I'm pretty sure you can see like the you know how you can see the outline.
The waves.
Yeah, you can see that outline. You know, when you see those sheets and they've been wet, how they turn a little like a yellow hue. You know?
I don't know what you guys are talking about. I have a question. You know, people that don't have TV, naturally, I have a hard time believing I would have anything to relate to them about. I know that's probably my problem, but I don't know, I feel like we have nothing in comics. TV is a very important thing to me, and I know people are going, oh, God, how lazy, TV. What? No, I love TV. There's so many great things on TV.
Oh,
I feel bad about all the things I miss.
Yeah. What do you do, go to a movie?
I know, I don't understand. How do you pass all the time? I mean, how bored are you? All those Simpsons episodes
I read.
You missed?
You read.
No, I don't.
I read. I feel like people don't have TV get off on saying they don't have TV. I feel like that's half the fun of not having TV is telling people you don't have TV, you're too good for TV, and maybe that's what I resent, is that you're being a snob, you're suggesting that I'm some weak, low-brow person who can't live without television.
Yeah, you are.
And it's a pathetic message. Yeah. I guess I am.
No, you're not. They are doing that. That is
exactly. Yeah, I think they are doing that.
They're TV shaming.
I'm onto
you.
Them. Yeah, they're TV shaming me. It's bullshit.
And the
like
rest
you're
of us.
The weird one. Everybody has a TV in this country.
Yeah, they're the aberrant
person.
Yeah, you're the outlier. Get a TV. Have some fun. Stop like, punishing yourself so you can sound cool.
I knew someone who was like, oh my God, you eat peanut butter? Gross. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Everybody loves peanut butter. You're the weird one, not me. Most people eat peanut butter?
Yeah, peanut butter improves the flavor of everything.
Unless you have a peanut allergy.
Oh, then you need to toughen up.
Well, you need to suck it up and eat a little bit at a time until you don't have allergies. You can appreciate peanut butter like the rest of us.
Acting like pussy. I eat peanut butter. I'm the weird one.
I'm waiting for the non-peanut butter school system for kids with peanut butter peanut allergies. Since there's so many of these kids and no one can be near peanut butter ever in their life if they're around your child.
Wow.
And I'm sorry if that's the case.
That'll be
I understand it's a problem.
But. Huge undertaking. Get all the personnel, the staff to be non-peanut butter types.
I mean, they're practically doing it in the public schools, it seems. Mm. Aren't they?
I have no idea.
I really thought that they had cured it, that they really had a routine for flipping that. Yeah, building the immunity back up or something.
Right. And in fact,
that's been recently. You're supposed to eat peanuts when you're a kid.
That's been recently. I've read about that recently. Somebody in one of the kids' classes had a peanut butter allergy, and they literally were saying, please don't eat peanut butter on Sunday because on Monday you would still have some scent of peanut butter about you, I guess.
Yeah. Well, don't smell my kid then.
I know. Believe me, I was appalled.
So close.
I was like, the kid needs to be in a bubble.
Yeah, homeschool.
You have a bubble, kid. Admit it. Put him in the bubble and shut up.
Charlotte goes to school a little bit, and her favorite thing about school is snack and who has the snack and who is bringing in the snack. One kid has a food allergy. And so she doesn't know, obviously doesn't know what it means. So
she's
every day
discriminated against.
What'd you have for snack? We had pumpkin muffins with chocolate chips, but. No, I don't want to say his name, but he had pretzels again. So every day, he had pretzels again.
Charlotte is snack-shaming this kid.
Well, no, she just is like, why did he have pretzels every day? Like, well, because he can't eat what everybody else. I mean, they're cool about it. It's not a problem, but
I have a
kid, poor kid just has to eat boring pretzels.
Yeah.
Pretzels suck.
And then Charlotte said,
oh, man, this is going to make a primo dump later on.
Does in fact, a peanut fart affect a child with a peanut allergy?
I could see that happening. Maybe that's why they didn't want him to have peanuts on Sunday or whatever the deal was.
When Charlotte goes to the bathroom, she'll get very upset if you flush it for her. Because it's a whole thing. You have to leave and turn off the light and go away, and she comes back and flushes it. I'm gonna start doing that, just leaving a turd in a toilet and turn off the light and shut the door and coming back later to flush it.
You learn from your child.
Hey, whatever works for her.
There's something to that.
She gets very upset if you flush it by accident.
Why? Because that's hers? Her work of art.
Hey, I'm not even going to argue with her.
They actually did say that at one point. Dr.
Kids do.
Spock thought that was a part of me. I don't believe that at all. I don't remember feeling like that.
Oh, I don't think chicks ever want to feel like that.
No. But the
I think guys do, kind
of. The theory why potty training is so difficult was supposedly that, oh my God, that's a part of me. Which is preposterous.
I think that's bullshit.
It is bullshit.
Not sure about that.
Most kids don't want it in their diaper, so take it off them so they can put it in the toilet.
True.
Absolutely. Did I do good, Daddy?
That's such a great drop.
CBS Morning Show, I mean, I'm telling you, CBS This Morning is actually a pretty good show.
Not bad.
They had a great segment on today about millennials.
Did they? What have they killed?
Should I cue it up, Drew?
Yeah, I read about it, and
let me find the video.
It's really funny how self-important. I think it says something when somebody will go on national television representing their generation.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't that tell you something about them?
Oh, maybe wait till you hear the buzzwords.
A little self-important.
Yeah, the buzzwords that come out of these idiots.
So the one
this
comment,
is a generation that is willing to pay dues.
The one guy that blows my mind says something to the effect that it's not all about working from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and that he thinks his generation deserves credit for working on life-work balance. I think it's life-work balance is the term. And all I know is if I was interviewing somebody and they said anything about how life...
Shut up, baby, Dick.
Life-work balance is important to them, and I know someone who actually was confronted with this term, and they immediately said, I'm not running this person's private life. They can't figure out how to balance these two things, and they're afraid to work too hard because it might hurt their life-work balance, then I just don't want to hire them.
Yeah, they're
and
gonna...
I think they thought they were asking a really cool and a very prescient question that maybe a lot of people bring up, but he was dead wrong.
Yeah. Well, they had these millennials on, but they had two sides of it, the older millennials and the younger millennials. I don't think the older millennials are too thrilled with the younger millennials.
Really? There's conflict
within millennials.
The generational...
Apparently.
Jeez.
I'm just waiting for this.
I love these.
Maybe millennials will kill themselves.
Two of the three younger ones live with their parents.
Sorry.
Yep, you got it.
And they said, but they don't depend on them.
And then the older millennial attacked them.
I don't blame them. That's, how can you say you don't depend on your parents?
They pay all their bills. That's what you said. except for Rent, apparently.
My generation, there are people who were born between.
I love the fact that CBS is doing a whole thing on Generation.
They make up the largest living generation, bigger than baby boomers and Generation X.
Ooh.
Their money, their attention, and their
There's
votes.
Way more baby boomers than Gen Xers.
Identifying millennials is complicated by a divide within the generation. Their formative years were split by the financial crisis, smartphones, and social media.
Oh, as if it was like the Depression or something.
I know.
Give me a break.
Reactions to stereotypes about them. Biana, good morning.
Oh, Nora, I felt so old talking to this group
this
of kids.
Hot,
we brought together a group. They're not kids, actually. They're adults, and they're a group from across the country featuring
the older
three
millennials, aged 30 to 34.
Yeah, and three younger millennials, ages 23 to 27. We met them at the New York City bar Porchlight to learn what unites and what divides them. There are a lot of stereotypes. Some are true, maybe some not so true about
nice
what people
diversity
say
too.
About millennials. I'm going to ask you if you agree or disagree. Millennials are entitled.
I agree with that.
Yes,
agree. Definitely agree.
They
Why
all
do you agree?
Agree?
I think we've been conditioned to used to being comfortable with things coming to us quickly, things being more convenient for us, getting things quicker.
Are these the younger ones?
My next question.
Yeah, that was the younger one.
Good, because I'm mad at
it. No, I don't agree with that.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was the older one.
I disagree with that. I work a full-time job, and then I come home and run a business.
That's why I think that we're not entitled.
Wait.
Is because of that.
She works a full-time job, and then she comes home and runs a business?
What kind of business is that, I'd like to know?
I can't be making that much money.
A full-time job, and then I come home, and then I run a
full-time
business.
Job, and
that's
I come home,
we're not entitled.
I come home, and then I run a business.
Of that entrepreneurial spirit that millennials have. But I think we're one of the hardest working generations because of the country that was left to us. We have to be.
Because
to
our
you?
Generation, and maybe this is also part of the millennial divide, the younger millennials came into the workforce with more knowledge and expertise in technology and social media.
Rich.
And so they're coming in and thinking like,
I deserve was no social media.
More. I deserve more faster.
Did you enter the job market before or after the financial crisis?
After.
Before.
After.
After.
Before.
Okay. And how would you say it has impacted your view on your financial situation and your career?
It has made me extremely driven.
Me too.
Because when I first entered the workforce, there were very limited jobs. And so I was competing for jobs with older men, like 45 years old. Uh-huh. I was in interviews with them. I also think that that is the difference between that maybe entitlement piece
you
that we're talking
like
about.
Pussy
I don't
me.
Fault the younger millennials for that. They're seeing, you know, 30-year-old men being CEOs and super successful and getting billions of dollars. And so I think that's what they expect.
How many of
please
you
pause.
Still live with your parents or depend on your parents?
What does someone else getting something have to do with you?
Nothing! Entitlement. She's saying that's why they feel entitled. Because there's 30-year-old CEOs now.
There are always whiz kids CEOs who start their own companies. That's nothing new. I cannot believe someone would even say something like that. First of all, do you look at someone else who has a completely different skill set and has gone a completely different path and say, I should have that too?
Of course not.
Who would even feign to think that? It's incredible.
I just can't wait to get home to run my business after work.
I really wish they'd followed up on that business.
Yeah. Whatever that means.
Well, stuffing envelopes.
Oh, Uber.
Just a sex operator.
Yeah, she's got a webcam.
Sex line.
I'm going to look
she's
it up after
got
this.
A webcam.
Maybe entitlement piece that we're talking about because
this
and I don't
dominating
fault
the conversation
for
though.
That. They're seeing, you know, 30-year-old men being CEOs and super successful and getting billions of dollars. And so I think that's what they expect.
Sure. How many of you still live with your parents or depend on your parents for financial help?
I live with my parents, but I don't depend on them.
Yeah, same.
You don't depend on your parents, but you live at their house. How does that work?
So I pay all my own bills,
yeah.
But I live with them.
Yes.
Let's move on.
No, not all your mortgage,
that's
too?
Really
that's, do they charge you rent? Because that's not all your
really
bills, honey.
For you to say.
You need a tissue? Should we take a moment?
That's very aggressive.
Does everyone feel like they need a trophy?
I think it's more of a respect thing. I think that a lot of what we do isn't respected. You know, I think that there's
then
a
it's not that good.
With previous generations
it.
And us. That there's not a respect for the skills that we do on a regular basis.
Okay, pause, please.
Doing a job doesn't necessarily.
Wait,
he, by the way, is wearing a bow tie. That guy hardly ever talks.
Yeah. This dude?
Yeah.
The only thing Luke has said so far, one of the younger millennials, is, how are you responsible for your financials when you live at home?
I know.
To his other, yeah, he's kind of
throwing shade on everybody.
I like his economy of commentary. The idea that you should be praised or respected because of, if you're not, then obviously they aren't that great. And by the way, this idea that you should move faster and you should move up because you've got social media skills. What? How many people have social media skills? Isn't that their entire generation?
Drew's on Twitter.
It's not a skill.
Yeah.
You got social media skills.
I'm sure they're better than I am at whatever they do, but isn't everyone their age? Doesn't everyone their age know how to use a computer backwards and forwards and social media?
Right. Yeah,
Why do they think that's some special skill? My generation was really good at asteroids and Pac-Man. I don't think I would dare suggest that should bring me something.
No.
I know it's a little different, but I'm just saying there were things that everyone my age did well or
my generation better was really than the previous good at apathy.
Well, I mean, if there's a power outage, there is something that your generation knows how to do that theirs doesn't. You can compute, you know, simple skilled things that they aren't capable of doing because everything has to be communicated electronically.
Mm-hmm. Or,
I guess is my point, but
I agree. I agree.
You got math skills and stuff like that. Things that
I agree. They sound so entitled. It's beyond belief. But again,
but if they're you, not. If, just ask them.
If you think that you speak
for
your generation,
I'm not entitled.
But even
2000, I have people skills.
2008, the great financial crisis that they're referring to, that was nowhere near as difficult as it was to survive the 30s. For our parents' generation.
But some of them, I'm sure, were told they had to go without for a little while.
Jesus, it affected me a lot.
What a night
it really did.
It's the dentist. I have a toothache. Oh, boy. Go ahead. Keep talking amongst yourselves.
Brandon, you're being, just sort of relegated out, so jump in.
No, I'm telling you, it affected me a lot. However, I'm not pissing and moaning.
How old were you in 07, 08?
I don't remember. I was like 24.
You don't remember?
did you? I mean, but there were people who couldn't eat. Like there were,
right.
They had to
exactly.
have soup kitchens.
I never
to
had
survive
a, I stuff. Never had to live in a tent in the park.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
However, everything did come crumbling down. I had a gig that I thought I was going to be a lifer, and I was going to, you know, make a ton of money, and it was going to be great. Mm. And then on, you know, the week of Christmas, we get an email that's saying, "Hey, next week we're closing doors. All 2,500 of you lose your jobs." Mm. And after that. Basically, it was going. I was in IT. I was applying for.
You had good skills.
I was applying for jobs, but everything, you know, the market had changed because so many individuals were out of a job that they were hiring for 50% pay cut.
Right. Yep.
And so, me, I was just like, I'm not going to take that, but I don't want to pay my student loans. So, I'm just going to go to a really short school. That way, I don't have to pay my student loans and continue to apply to IT jobs. And that led me to go into specs and then meeting you guys. And then it kind of just. Turned the entire career path around because then I jumped into radio instead of getting back into IT. And now it's kind of dumb because I look back now.
You stayed in IT.
Well, if you get out of IT for 10 years and you try to jump back in, it you feel like an idiot. I mean, we had that issue just earlier today where we can't get the internet working. And here I am with an IT degree and I'm a moron with it.
Well, at least you strategized though. You didn't just sort of flail helplessly. You strategized something. You're like, I'll do this until I can get, you know, a foothold here or...
Yeah.
And it took you in a different direction.
I don't want to hear these other millennials whining about it because I guarantee you the recession affected their parents far more than it affected them.
I know. They were protected in a way. So.
And, you know, and in a way, it did affect my dad more than it affected me because all
I had
to do...
You think it affected your parents more or you?
I think it affected my parents greatly because it led to financial woes and ultimately their divorce and ultimately my dad lost his job and he lost his house. So all I had to do was just get a new job at the age of 24.
Yeah.
Big fucking deal. I can do that.
Not only that, but then the people of your father's age and your parents' age, they also had the, you know, tech boost and blow up in the early 2000s.
Yeah. Right. Well, exactly. When my father lost his gig, it wasn't like he could just jump into, you know, a tech field.
Yeah.
That's not what he was educated on. That wasn't around when he was going through his education. So,
you know, that was weird because when we were going through all of that, there were people. Remember when Michigan had the jobs program? So they were trying to retrain people
who were
blown out of car companies. I had a couple of interns.
Which is smart.
Who were in their like late 30s or 40s who had been blown out and they were going to specs because they didn't know what to do. And so they became interns and were working at the radio station. Yeah. And doing well because they, you know, they had the work ethic of this person who had been in corporate.
It's all about finding an irreplaceable skill.
Yeah. Eventually, though, because I'm like, God, you picked radio as your...
I know.
But they've all gone back in now that, you know, business has resumed and it's healthy again. And they've gone back. But sure. That was the weirdest thing, was getting this group of people who are in their 40s who are at that point trying to make a career pivot.
Sucks.
Yeah.
It was insane.
Where's the rest of these turds?
I think that a lot of what we do isn't respected. You know, I think that there's a disconnect with previous generations and us, that there's not a respect for the skills that we do on a regular basis that they...
I can't believe how introspective this generation is. Who sits around and thinks about their generation is more than millennials?
The only generation I'm thinking about is Gen Z, because they're funny to me. This kid is funny to me, and so...
Well, the next generations always are. Did you know they're the most advanced technological generation ever?
Did you know they only
not
have
like
an
open
attention
office
span of 8 seconds?
Doing a job doesn't necessarily deserve a pat on the back.
Yeah, Lou.
I mean, you have a job to do and you did it. It's not like a congratulations, you did it.
Duh.
That sounds like the dude from the American Vandal.
Are you more likely to text or email with somebody or actually talk to them?
He looks like him
too.
Probably text.
Oh yeah, none of them talk on phones.
Rude and intrusive to call someone, right?
Is rude to call somebody?
I think it can be, like, depending on what you're calling for. For example, like, I work in a sales job. Well, if I call someone, I feel like they are more annoyed with me than if they can just respond to a text on
their
own.
That's insane if you're in sales.
What is your overall perception?
Should be able to talk to somebody.
Yeah. I think overall, younger millennials are very intelligent.
You know, I was thinking today, you lie so much easier in a text message than you could on the phone. Mm-hmm.
Accidental text on purpose?
Oh, no, I've done that, but you...
Did you see Curb?
Oh, no, I didn't see Curb.
That was from...
Damn it.
It was like 2 weeks ago. Trudy, slow down. He was having people send accidental texts on purpose. And then, of course, it blew up in his face because everybody knows the accidental text on purpose.
Larry thought
he was so genius for inventing it.
But you know what? You can so easily lie, you know, like, hey, why don't you come, you know, like, meet me here or something
Oh, no, I'm at a big conference in Seattle.
There's no tone. There's no context.
All right.
You can sit for, you know, hours to think of a response.
Yeah.
You can Google. You're coming up with your response.
Intelligent. Yeah. I think they are very entrepreneurial. I think that they are entitled, but I don't necessarily
think
that that is.
That's an older millennial ragging on
cases.
The younger ones.
I think younger millennials had it a little harder than us in terms of the constant pressure and comparison from having social media
fucking
all the time.
Who?
But I think the challenge is going to be to kind of get better at listening in addition to sort of projecting.
And let me ask the younger millennials what your overall perception of your older peers are.
They have a lot of the qualities that we have.
You had me and then you lost me.
The older generation has. So we can glean a lot from them because of that.
What are you talking about? What does that even mean?
I agree completely. You guys are like the transitional generation or phase, and you guys are kind of spearheading our whole generation as a whole.
Luke doesn't give a shit about buzzwords.
No. Luke just had a good point, and this is how I feel about it, is the fact you can't just take one group, one entire generation, and just lump them in. I know a lot of Gen X.
Of course not, but that's
I know a lot of Gen Z kids that are cool as shit. And there's baby boomers who are complete assholes and they've messed up their lives. I don't know. Ultimately, not all the same. I hate grouping everyone.
You got a broad brush.
I think that's terribly divisive, putting people in generational
groups. No, you broad brush everyone. If you're part of a group, you're all the same. That's what makes the world fun.
Not a pressure.
I want to hear Luke again.
Luke is like our sleeper old soul among us.
Yeah, he is. He's a wise old man,
arguably
Luke.
More.